Hey everyone, welcome to the Front Judge Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now in a moment, I'll be joined by my colleague Mike Neff, and we have a loaded show for you guys today. Last week, we gave our thoughts on NASCAR returning in an instant analysis podcast on Friday, so this week we're discussing some virtual racing at Dover from this past weekend. And I don't know if you guys have been keeping up with it, but over the past 4 weeks, ESPN has been doing a 10-part documentary series called The Last Dance, which features the 1990s dynasty team that the Chicago Bulls built, as well as the career of Michael Jordan. And I've been enjoying it so much that Neff and I are going to give you our top 5 list of drivers that we'd like to see in documentary form. Mine are more present, Neff on the other end, more from the 1960s through 80s. Finally, Corey LaJoy joins the podcast to discuss NASCAR's return to racing, what it's going to be like racing 1,600 miles in 11 days, and recently becoming a father. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Judge Podcast on Apple Podcasts. And as of this week, this is big news, we're also on Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and TuneIn. We're also welcoming Manscaped on as a sponsor. So make sure to go to manscaped.com and use code FRONTSTRETCH for 20% off and free shipping. Now let's talk some racing with Neff. All right, Neff. Last Friday we published a kind of an instant analysis podcast on NASCAR announcing it would return to the track next Sunday, May 17th, with the Cup Series taking to the track Too Tough to Tame at Darlington, kind of your neck of the woods. I know then we were both in favor, but it's been about a week since the initial announcement. Do you still have the same feelings that NASCAR should return?
Absolutely. I'm excited about it. It would be awesome to have fans there, but I understand that there's a myriad of factors at play in this thing, and it's a matter of just getting this thing rolling. I'm excited and curious to see what the schedule announcement is going to be when they announce that, because they're supposed to be rolling out the full schedule on the 17th. So we'll find out what the plans are, what tracks are going to lose dates. There's supposed to be 3 tracks losing dates, and I think we both resigned ourselves to Sonoma being one of them, but we'll figure out the other two. But it's been funny watching social media and all the different people that are postulating the tracks losing dates, like Pocono and Dover, and it's like pretty sure both of those tracks not only are not losing a date, but they're going to have doubleheaders, which is going to be a fun experience. So, yeah, I'm excited for racing to be back. I've had a good time with virtual racing, but I need to see actual sheet metal being traded instead of cars flipping upside down and hanging on catch fences.
And driving through one another. Yeah, Adam Stern of Sports Business Journal reported on Monday that it looks like one road course, one short track, and one intermediate track will be the 3 tracks that have been replaced. Now, when they say short track, I'm not seeing Richmond, Bristol, or Martinsville being thrown out of the equation. First of all, they're good races. They're all within, you know, close proximity to Charlotte. And 3 of them are in the playoffs. So I would imagine...
And I don't see Phoenix going.
Exactly.
That's
so,
your championship weekend.
Exactly. So that leaves probably New Hampshire. And I've heard that that's a track that could be, and it's unfortunate because they went from having 2 races per year until, 2018, and then they had 1 race 2018, 2019, and potentially none this year. So that would be horrible for them in their market, being, you know, in the Boston market, only an hour and a half from Boston. But, look, unfortunately, that's going to happen. Some of these tracks are going to at least not have a race this year. Sonoma, I would imagine that's almost a foregone conclusion. C. Phelps was on the Dale Jr. download this week. I listened to that right before we fired up this morning. And he mentioned that the schedule is about 99% of the way done. And they're just kind of weaving in and out and trying to figure out what tracks aren't going to be on the schedule. I think they got a pretty good idea. But it'll be interesting what the intermediate track is, because you've heard Chicagoland, could be Kentucky, although Kentucky's a lot closer to Charlotte than Chicago. So
right.
We don't want to...
Yeah, that would really frustrate me if New Hampshire loses it, because... I mean, that market supported the Cup races even when they had 2, and then after they lost one, still when they had the 1 left, they have had some of the strongest fan attendance numbers of any of the tracks on the schedule, and it would be highly disappointing to think that they would lose the date. But again, when you're dealing with running this schedule and trying to get all these races in a combined time space, we start looking at distance to travel to get to them. And in the grand scheme of things, the tracks that are furthest away, you know, from Charlotte that are most likely going to lose the dates would be Sonoma, California we've already run, Vegas we've already run. We're not going to lose Phoenix. So then you go Chicago and New Hampshire are probably the next closest ones outside of Texas. And in all honesty, I think Texas is probably as close as Chicago is. So it makes sense if we're trying to stuff this in and we're trying to cut down on travel time, that would be the tracks to lose dates.
For sure. I think it's a good thing also that we had the West Coast swing, because that easily could have been a few markets. That easily could have been a few markets that, you know, were affected by this as well, with dates being taken away. Just because, like you said, the location of some of these venues, the travel involved, and right now there's not going to be a lot of travel for the at least foreseeable future, including the first 2 weeks with Darlington and Charlotte both race having two races each. But Neff, there's still obviously a lot of risk involved in returning, and especially being one of the first sports back. I heard UFC is going to be back this Saturday, May 9th in Jacksonville. Obviously, we've talked about WWE ad nauseum on here. I'm a big WWE fan, and they've been doing tapings every couple weeks and sometimes live in Orlando at the Performance Center. But NASCAR needed to come back, and we talked a little bit about this. Is it right? Is it wrong? I don't know. Is it too early? Maybe. I guess we'll find out. It's going to go either really good or really bad. But there's risk involved for everyone.
Yep. There's risk involved in opening up all these economies. And we have to deal with the frustration of different media outlets putting different spins on things and how they interpret them. So I'm hoping that everybody involved in this deal is going to go at it from the perspective of, we need sports as a distraction.
True.
And, you know, for those of us that are racing fans, NASCAR is a great distraction for us. And it's time. You know, people are, I think people swallowed this pill for 4 to 6 weeks pretty well. But we're to a point now where people are stir crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're really starting to be at a tipping point of things getting ugly from emotional standpoints. And people just need a release. And I hope that NASCAR is going to provide that.
For sure. And there's going to be all eyes on NASCAR, at least for the first couple of weeks, I would imagine. I would imagine the first race back at Darlington is going to do some of the biggest ratings we've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I have to agree.
Possibly bigger than the Daytona 500. This year was a little different because it was run on a Monday primarily. And we had all that momentum going into the race with the president being there. And it just felt, you could feel the atmosphere being there. It's very, very great. But then Monday, you know, it spilled into because of the rain. But I would think that it's going to be a very highly watched race and bring in fans that we haven't had before. And maybe it even cross them over. You know, maybe they're a basketball fan or a football fan. Well, now they see a race and they're like, oh, we never gave it a shot before. Now they're giving it a shot and they turn into fans. That's how this is going to work. So that's a good sign. But if someone were to get sick, they're going to have to self-isolate for 14 days if they get the coronavirus. Hopefully that doesn't happen. But as we talked about last week, Neff, there's a very good chance because they're bringing 16 people per car. That's
right.
That's my opinion. I think your opinion too. Way too many.
It seems like an awful lot.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking 16 times, you know, 40. That's a lot of people. It adds up very quickly. Hundreds of people, as opposed to, you know, 21 on a normal weekend. And that's when you think of the smaller teams like your Rick Ware Racing or Go Fast or even like Richard Petty Motorsports. A lot of the smaller teams, Starcom. At the cup level, it even gets worse at Xfinity and trucks. There's gonna be crossover between the shop guys and the road guys. It'll have to be.
Yeah, without a doubt, you've got guys that especially as you said, at these smaller teams that work in a shop during the week and go to the track. They don't have the luxury that the big teams do of having completely separate groups that have very little, if any, crossover. So that is an extra concern for these smaller teams because, as you said, if somebody gets it, they have to self-isolate. And if that is somebody that works in your shop, not only are you losing somebody working at the racetrack, you're losing somebody at your shop as well. So it's especially risky for these smaller teams, but I don't know of any team that I've heard of that doesn't want to take the chance because it's a greater risk to their financial survival if we don't go back to racing.
Totally agree. Outside of that, really not much news over the past week. Something I'll probably break now before this podcast is published. But Matt Kenseth, we went over that return last week in depth. NASCAR did have a rules update this week. Neff, you'll help me with this one because they're making some technical changes. As a result of Ryan Newman's horrific crash at Daytona in February, they have an addition of a lower main roll bar and support bar, an intrusion plate to the upper main roll bar support bar, an elimination of aero ducts at super speedway tracks. Found that kind of to be interesting. They got reduction size in throttle body, updated roll bar padding specifications that come into effect beginning June 1st, oil reservoir tank on overflow expansion. We saw that oil pouring out of Newman's car. Everyone feared it was gasoline after Daytona. And then there's some other changes as well. A lot of this seems to be effective at the super speedways tracks. But obviously, it's we might be getting a second Newman bar. And it's obviously to keep the car safer.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily a bar as much as a support. But I think it's all, in looking at the diagrams and the stuff that they sent out with this, it basically looks like it's designed to increase the structural integrity of the upper part of the greenhouse because on the doors and on the leg area, there's been a lot of support added over the years. We've got the intrusion plates on the side of the cars, the added foam on the side of the cars. So all of that is designed to keep the integrity of the greenhouse so you're not getting things penetrating in and getting to the driver. Unfortunately, the way the thing is designed, and in reality, it's probably something that we didn't even think about, the odds of a guy getting hit when he's upside down.
Right.
You know, I mean, we saw it when Jeff Bodine wrecked in the truck. We've seen it a handful of times. Earnhardt broke his sternum on one. We've seen Tony Stewart upside down and get hit in there, but most of them, even at that point, the upper part of the cage stayed pretty well intact. This one with Newman, just the way it worked out, the difference in speed between him and Corey LaJoy was so significant that it caused the upper part of the cage to collapse. And I think that's the wake-up call that we got out of this event. We always learn from any time we have a major incident, and it looks like what we've looked at this one is trying to strengthen up or shore up that upper part of the cage without taking away visibility too much or obstructing driver view. You also have a check valve on the oil tank. That's something that I know from my go-kart days back in the years, you used to have a check valve on top of the gas tank. So if a go-kart got upside down and gas didn't flow out, same thing's going on here. Because, as you said, we saw that oil pouring out of Newman's car, and we were pretty worried that it was fuel, but fortunately it was oil and it did not ignite, because that could have been a horrible event. So, and the other one that I find curious is the reduction of the size of the throttle body, simply because we're using the tapered spacer to already reduce airflow going in. So reducing the size of the throttle body is cutting down air before it even gets to that tapered spacer. And it's going to even put more challenge to the engine builders and getting horsepower out of these engines. So I'm thinking it's something that, you know, maybe they felt like these guys were already starting to creep back up to that 600 horsepower level. And so they want to try and knock it back down so they attack the throttle body. But I would like to know the logic. And if we get a chance to talk to somebody at the track, whenever we finally get back to track, we'll ask them about that.
Yeah, I'm interested in the timing of this announcement. Obviously coming out late last week. That would have been a week after Talladega. Talladega was obviously supposed to be run the previous weekend. I would have met, I know that, you know, the NASCAR and D-Center, that these modifications started to go into effect pretty rapidly after Daytona when they got Newman's car, they got Corey LaJoie's car. They looked it over. They went over all the timelines and the details and everything, all the knowledge that they needed in order to make a safety enhancement like this. So, obviously, for the better of the sport, in terms of adding the bars, anything to keep these drivers safe, because we don't want something like that to happen at Daytona again. Although, I mean, let's face it, there's a lot of danger involved in this sport. So you can't, who would have thought that would have happened? But overall, glad that they're making some changes, and especially the super speedways, to keep those cars hopefully on the ground, but more importantly, safe. Now, moving on, we did have some virtual racing over the weekend at Dover, virtual Dover. I gotta be honest, this wasn't among my favorites of the six virtual races. William Byron got his third win. I think now that we see a finish line, we see a date in sight of a return cup race, and I know they're going to North Wilkesboro this week, and I guess we can hit on that a little bit, but this, I don't know, I'm kind of over iRacing at this point.
Yeah, I'm with you. It was one of those that was just really kind of tough to swallow. And unfortunately, we've almost seen this at regular Dover too. You know, it used to be that it was a track that would slowly move up. I want to say Casey Kane was probably the first one that really made the highline work there. And we got to where you had multiple racing grooves and it was the monster and it would clean itself off. And you had some pretty good wrecks. But in the iRacing model, it doesn't appear as though the groove moves up. And so everybody's locked into that groove at the bottom. And you can't really bump and run because you're going so fast. And the way you drop in and bounce out of the corners, it just doesn't really set itself for it. And as a result, you saw it there at the end when William Byron had better tires than the guys in front of him. He ends up sending Landon Castle pretty hard, and it was one of those deals where it was time to go, and Byron had to go, and unfortunately Landon was in the way. I know Landon didn't take it very well and has made some promises about what's going to happen going forward. We'll see how that works out. But, yeah, as it has gone along, I know what they tried to do with the fixed setups, but I really think we're at a point now where we need to start allowing these guys to tweak these setups a little bit, because it seems like the races are getting more and more boring.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, like I'm happy that there's still some sort of racing to watch, and I know that there's obviously dirt racing back now in the Midwest and even farther out west like South Dakota like we talked about last week. But it's hard. There's nine cautions in this race for 40 laps. So I guess the average amount of time under caution is less, because last week or the week before that, not at Talladega, but where was it, Richmond, it was six for 36 laps. So six laps, now you're down to about four and a half per caution. But, and I know, you know, we want to get a lot of people, not necessarily us, want to get these races shorter on the real schedule. Well, this is 150 miles. It took an hour and a half. It just seemed like forever, in my opinion. I don't know if I wasn't bored watching it, but it just, obviously it's different in I don't know how to explain how I'm feeling, because it was just there's a timeline to get back now to the real track, and I'm very excited for it, to say the least.
I'm with you. Yeah, it kind of seemed to just drag on. It didn't seem like that excitement level was there that was with it the first few races. And you know, even in this one, Timmy Hill's there with a shot at the lead coming down the end, but he didn't have the tires that Byron did. Byron pulls in front of him, and it was pretty much over after that. If Timmy had been able to hold the bottom and force Byron to move him, we might be having a little different discussion today. But since Timmy washed up and Byron drove under him and just drove away, it didn't really have that suspense that we look for at the end of the race. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think this filled a hole, but it's time to get back to the real thing.
Totally agree. I guess tire wear does matter. I mean, I've driven a Cup Crown iRacing once, but it wasn't in a race. It was a practice session. So, and that was at Charlotte. I don't know how the tire wear like is comparable to the real life Dover. I mean, last year there wasn't much tire wear. They're also going very, very fast last year at Dover. But we saw at least on Sunday that within the first, I think the second caution was lap 24, maybe even the third caution, and drivers are already pitted twice. So I guess tire wear mattered quite a bit there. And like you said on the late race restart there with William Byron, I guess we can get into that now because this could lead to some, I don't know if it'll lead to real life rivalries or not, but William Byron turned Landon Castle with a restart with, I believe, five laps to go. Like you mentioned, Landon tweeted out that night how he was as mad after that incident as he would have been had it happened in real life. And then he then said if he could catch Byron, I don't know if he meant in real life, probably more virtually, that he's going to dump him next time. So, I mean, do you feel like this could translate over to the real world, like the Matt DiBenedetto and Ryan Preece's incident from a few weeks ago, which looked like maybe it could, based on videos we watched?
I mean, in theory, if a guy feels like somebody did him wrong, whether it was virtual or not virtual, unless you talk it out and work it out, absolutely there can be some grudges there. And as we've seen in the Michael Jordan documentaries, grudges tend to drive these guys. And so if you need to have a perceived slight, or having that chip on the shoulder helps you drive better or harder or faster, absolutely run with it. I think you'll have some carryover. I would hope that we won't have Landon tearing up an actual race car when he gets back to real racing, but at the same time, if he does, you know, it's the passion and the drive that we want to see out of this sport. So I don't know that fans would be that upset if it actually did spill over to that. It might add some excitement and drama.
Landon's also got to find a cup ride because he's...
There is that.
Because he's an Xfinity driver primarily for Morgan Shepherd. So I think it was more meant virtually, and rightfully so, too. I mean, I'd be frustrated if I was Landon. I think him and William, and then we can get into, you know, Parker Kligerman and Timmy Hill. Those have been four of the guys that have been at the forefront, spending probably the most time of all drivers. Hell, Landon and Parker did a 24-hour race in Garrett Smithley a couple weeks ago. Yeah, I would have been frustrated if I was Landon. You're spending all that time trying to hone in on your craft and just to get dumped with five laps to go. I mean, I've never been in that position, you know, with real competition in terms of racing like this, but I would be frustrated.
Yeah, as you said, he's trying to get a cup ride. So this is his way of showing off his skill set, and to get unceremoniously dumped like that is frustrating to say the least. So, you know, as again, he's normally a predominant Xfinity driver, doesn't get all that many opportunities to run up front in a cup race. And so he's in a virtual cup race running up front. And, you know, it wasn't like he got the Ted Christopher three bump deal either. I mean, it was a matter of they dropped the green, Byron put it under him and freaking wrecked him. So I could absolutely see where he'd be upset, and, you know, I don't know if they talked or not, but if they didn't, then we very well may see him if he gets an opportunity to go after William.
For sure, and I do know that Parker Kligerman and Timmy Hill talked about it. Parker sent out a tweet later on Sunday evening. Neff, anything else on the Versal race? I guess we could talk about North Wilkesboro quick. The race in there Saturday night instead of Martinsville, which would have been the Cup schedule. I'm happy personally that they're going to North Wilkesboro. Dale Earnhardt Jr. was at the forefront of that in December, as we talked about on a podcast over the offseason. Going up, kind of restoring at least the track part, the track surface part of that track. Obviously, there's a lot of work to be done, you know, between the grandstands, the infield, the garages, I guess, were falling apart to even ever think about having a race there. However, it is good that we'll virtually be able to see it, and who knows, maybe this will change my mind on virtual racing.
I mean, it's going to get people talking. I promise you that. People are always talking about North Wilkesboro, and even seeing it in a virtual world is going to get that fire stoked even more, and you're going to have a lot of people pushing for it, asking for it. And is it possible? Sure. Is it probable? Heck no. Odds are highly against it ever happening. But as I said last week, if there was ever an opportunity to do it, now's that opportunity, because they're putting on races with no fans in the stands. And so you could have a race there and pull it off. But again, I don't picture it happening. It's going to be fun to relive those days. You know, I was around when it came back to life. I went to every race that they had, worked with Alton McBride and helped out a little bit with the PR and stuff up there. And it was an amazing experience. And I look forward to seeing virtual cars out there. I look forward to hearing Jeff Gordon talk about his experience being the last winner there. I hope, like everybody's talking, you're going to get a lot of retro paint schemes. I think that'll be really neat if they do it. But in the grand scheme, it's just going to be really cool to see cars at a track that, in all honesty, none of us ever thought we'd see again.
For sure. Well, Neff, at the beginning of the podcast, I mentioned that we got a sponsor for this week. So support, for sure. So support for the French Edge podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision engineered tools for your family jewels. Now, Neff, I don't know how much details I want, but has there ever been a time where you've maybe had a manscaping injury?
I won't deny it has happened in the past. Similar to a minor cut on your head, there's a lot of blood flow the family jewel area, and even a small nick can turn into a mess. And if you have a white rug in your bathroom, your girlfriend will not be very happy if you do have a little bit of a manscaping issue. So fortunately for us, with the guys at Manscaped, we don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah. Personally, I hate razor bumps. And fortunately, that's why Manscaped has redesigned the electric trimmer. The Manscaped engineering team spent 18 months perfecting the greatest ball hair trimmer ever created and just released the new and improved Lawnmower 3.0. Their third-generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to prevent manscaping in accidents. Millions of balls are about to be nick-free thanks to Manscaped's advanced skin-safe technology. Manscaping accidents are finally in the rearview mirror.
And I'll tell you what, when we tell you this is premium, we mean premium. The battery will last up to 90 minutes, so you can take a nice, long, relaxing shave. One of the coolest features is the LED light, which illuminates grooming areas for a closer, more precise trim. They've also upgraded to a 7,000 RPM motor with quiet stroke technology. Let's not forget about the charging stand either. Show your mower off loud and proud because the intelligently designed stand is a convenient charging dock powered by a USB.
So if you're listening to us speak right now, I want you to experience this firsthand for yourself and trim that junk of yours. So get 20% off and free shipping with the code FRENCHSTRETCH at manscaped.com. Again, get 20% off and free shipping with the code FRENCHSTRETCH at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. And use the code FRENCHSTRETCH, FRONTSTRETCH.
Your balls will thank you.
For sure. Well, Neff, I want to talk about The Last Dance because we've talked about it off record. While not recording, a few weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, as this podcast comes out, the ESPN and Netflix moved up the start date to The Last Dance, Michael Jordan, which focuses on the 1990 Bulls and specifically Michael Jordan's career. On Sunday night, I was watching. I've been fascinated with this whole documentary. I love it. That's great. I think we need more of that in sports, personally. I love docuseries. So I asked out to my Twitter followers and got pretty good response, over 40. What NASCAR driver, past or present, could use a Last Dance, or would you like to see them have a Last Dance kind of documentary? So I know for me, I've put together a list of 4, and I can go to 5 or 6 or however many you want to talk about that have kind of, I would like to see a docuseries on their success and their careers as a whole. And I know you've done the same. So this should be fun.
Absolutely. I was a huge Bulls fan, lived in Chicago for the first 3 championships, and watching The Last Dance has just reopened the old wounds of how much I hate Jerry Krause and how much his ego destroyed that whole thing. But it's been interesting and entertaining. I've always known that Jordan was driven, but I didn't realize how much. And hearing the story about how he actually went and in like post discussion about it, in the documentary, they made it sound like he went to Vegas to get Rodman back. It was actually in Chicago. Rodman was living in an apartment across the street from the United Center. And Jordan showed up, grabbed him by the nose ring, and dragged him out of the apartment to come back and play. And I hear these stories, and you know what you saw when I went to games and I watched them, and you now understand better why everything you saw transpired. And so I'm with you. There's a bunch of guys that I would like to see in the NASCAR world. And the interesting thing for me, since you and I talked about this before we started recording the podcast, is you're much younger than I am. You're in your 20s. I'm in my 50s. And my vision and the guys I want to learn about are the guys that brought me into the sport.
Right.
So I'm looking at David Pearson, Junior Johnson, guys like that, where you're 30 years behind me. So you're looking at Jeff Gordon, Jimmy Johnson, and guys like that. And it's there's two unique and different stories that I think we would get depending on which generation of drivers we got to follow.
Totally agree with you on that. The list I have, and like you mentioned, we were talking about this before we recorded. Looking back on it, these are the drivers. I was a big Bobby Labonte fan growing up. I've, said that on this podcast, said it publicly before. But these are the drivers who really carried NASCAR over the past 30 years. So I definitely want to talk about my list, your list, as much as I can. I do know, obviously, a lot of, all the drivers on your list. But there, when I look at my Twitter notifications, there's a lot of Tony Stewarts, a lot of Dale Earnhardts. People wanted docs on these drivers. Some Jimmy Johnson, some Jeff Gordon. Oops, I just gave away my four drivers that I have listed. However, there was also from back, in the 1970s and 1980s, you got your Tim Richmonds, your Dick Trickles. David Pearson had a lot from the 1980s, as did Richard Petty. So I guess I'll start off with you. Give me, if you had one pick, this is hard because I've narrowed mine down to two. If you had one pick, who do you think it would be?
If I have one, it's going to be Junior Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's such a dynamic character. There's so much of a story to his life face it, he made NASCAR. I mean, NASCAR was a struggling regional sport, and he selflessly turned R.J. Reynolds over to NASCAR and basically brought Winston to the sport rather than keeping him for himself. But you have the moonshiner side of him, you have the driver side, and then you have the car owner side. And not only do I want to hear all aspects of that, but I want to hear, and this is a part of these things that I'm really intrigued by, is the off-track, away-from-track stuff. And I have friends that ran with Junior Johnson and knew him back in the day, and they talk about speed weeks at Daytona. And Junior would come down with three or four cars loaded with moonshine and rent the entire floor of a hotel for 2 weeks. And you had cars end up in the swimming pool and people just running around from room to room doing God knows what. And just those stories on top of how he engineered some of the finest race cars without ever having any kind of engineering training at all. And, whether it's true or not, he's given credit with discovering the draft and taking an underpowered car and winning the Daytona 500 with it because he figured out how to suck up behind cars and get more speed out of an underpowered car. So if I had one to pick, it's going to be Junior Johnson.
That's definitely a good pick. And a you know, there was such a loss to the NASCAR world one in December when he ended up passing. So that would be a great pick. There's so many legends of this sport, and there's so many to pick from, and there's really no wrong answer. Like, you could, we saw it with the Motor Trend app, you know, leading up to Daytona, even then through Daytona. They followed Corey LaJoie, Tyler Reddick, and Austin Dillon around. I don't know if you watched that series enough. It was a five-part series, really good. They're all about 40, 45 minutes each. And granted, it wasn't, you know, on one driver specifically. It was three, and it was just for a very short period of time. But there's room for this in the sport. I truly believe that. Like I mentioned earlier, though, I'm a big fan of docuseries. So I like your Junior Johnson pick. I'm so torn between my two. If we're going to base it off the Jordan doc specifically and kind of that whole aspect of, you know, him getting drafted by the Bulls, well, and then his relationship with all the players, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman both had episodes on the series. I think that was episodes two and three. I got to go Jeff Gordon. He had four champions, obviously, all, you know, all in the 1990s and the 2001. His rivalry with Dale Earnhardt, that alone, I mean, Fox last year came out with the Unrivaled documentary with Dale Earnhardt and Jeff Gordon. That was great, I thought. And if you're looking at, you know, kind of comparing it to the Jordan doc, I don't think Jeff Gordon's the greatest driver of all time. I do think he's top five. I don't think he's the greatest. However, at his time, he was the Chicago Bulls. And it's funny because it's kind of the same timeline as the Chicago Bulls-Detroit Pistons, while Dale Earnhardt was the Detroit Pistons, kind of the bad guy, kind of roughing up the younger fresh blood, you know what I mean? So, yep. And while Earnhardt was in the later part of his career, obviously, unfortunately, died in the 2001 Daytona 500, Gordon was on his way to superstardom, which he then reached. Won 10 races in three consecutive years between 96 and 98. And then the whole aspect of him and Ray Evernham, the relationship there, and you could argue who was the top guy? Was it Gordon or was it Evernham?
Right.
That kind of reminds me of the Jordan doc. And then Evernham obviously left for Dodge in 02. Or was it 02. And Gordon's really never the same. He won 44 races over the final 16 years of his career. So I think Jeff Gordon's the number one guy. My number two, very close behind, is Jimmy Johnson. And I'll go into detail about that. Who's your number two?
Yeah, the Gordon one's interesting because, as you said, I tend to feel like it was Evernham that was really the driving force behind that team. And I honestly feel like Jeff was the talent. Don't get me wrong. He's a great talent. You said top five. I'm borderline right there. I've got him right in that 5 to 7 category of best drivers ever. So I'm a little torn on that one, but I feel like it was Evernham that drove that team more than Jeff did. And by the way, Evernham was gone before 2001. 2001, Robbie Loomis.
Yeah, it was 2000.
The crew chief.
2000 was the last year.
My second one that I would like to see is David Pearson. I've always felt like in my heart, David Pearson is my favorite stock car driver. I don't know that he's the best, but he's right up there. And again, I would like to know the pieces that drove him, because he was, for the most part in his career, he was a true mercenary. He was kind of like Mark Martin in the Busch series. You know, he would go run the big money races and not worry about championships. And in his career, he seriously ran for a title three times. He seriously won the title all three times. So you wonder if he had had that focus like Petty did and really gone for it, how many would he have really won? But his deal was he wanted to drive good cars or great cars in big money races where he had a chance to really make the funds. And so that was why he spent so much time riding with the Wood Brothers. And again, I'd love to know that off-track story for Pearson. He's not that flamboyant kind of character that you that you associate with Junior Johnson or my third pick, which we'll get to in a minute. But he just was so cool. I mean, you think of, you know, Clint Eastwood cool or Marlon Brando cool from back in that time. You had David Pearson. The only car on Thunder Road in the NASCAR Hall of Fame that has a working cigarette lighter is the Wood Brothers David Pearson car, as he literally would smoke during races. And I mean, feel what you want about smoking, but it's pretty cool when you light up while you're racing. So he's one of those guys, and it was funny when he was getting inducted into the Hall of Fame. I'm friends with some people that work at the Hall, and they were talking about the fact that David was a bit of a ladies' man back in his time, and even though he was well up in years by the time he was inducted into Hall of Fame, he still had an eye for the ladies, and he had a lot of work to do to kind of keep him on focus when he was at the Hall of Fame ceremonies, because he was trying to get the attention of the ladies.
I'd say he ran for the championship really 4 years, and he did win three of them, because in 64 he ran 61 of 62 races. That's so, you know, obviously unprecedented compared to today's age, where you run 60, high 50s, high 40s races per year. Obviously, for the past number of years, we've been at 36, or at least in the 30s. He ran for in 64 and had 8 wins, finished 3rd in points. But yeah, like you said, 66, 15 wins, 68, 16 wins, 69, 11 wins. And then this is kind of astonishing, too. In 73, he ran 18 of the 28 races, won 11 of them. So
yeah,
it's pretty good win percentage. So yeah, 105 wins over 574 starts. I mean, that's pretty damn good. So I would also be intrigued with a documentary featuring David Pearson. My number two kind of spoiled it, Jimmy Johnson. And I go back and forth between him and Jeff Gordon. Honestly, coming into this podcast, I thought Jimmy was going to be my number one. And just talking to you pre-taping and Gordon's rivalry with Earnhardt, I think Gordon kind of surpasses Jimmy a little bit. But Jimmy, obviously, I'd like to go in depth on his 5 championships in a row, his relationship with Chad Knaus. I don't think that 5 championships in a row is ever going to be passed again, especially with this format. You know, Kyle Busch has been, he's probably the next superstar after Jimmy Johnson. You know, we talked about this also, where it seems like throughout NASCAR's existence, a superstar passes on to the next superstar, to the next superstar, and so forth. Kyle Busch is that next superstar, I feel like. He's been a superstar for years. However, he's been to 5 straight championship 4 races and has only won 2 of them. So that just goes to show you how hard a championship is to win. Doesn't matter the point format. But yeah, he won 5 in a row. I'd love to, you know, go in depth in that between 2006, 2010, have all that inside information. His relationship with Chad Knaus, because as we've talked about numerous of times on this podcast, Neff, that wasn't always, you know, rainbows and sunshine, that relationship.
Nah, man, a cookies and milk meeting.
Yeah, for sure. He had 35 wins in those 5 years, including 10 in 2007. But you look at his whole career, I think he is the Michael Jordan of NASCAR. I think he is the greatest of all time. And I think if you look 15, 20 years from now, when he's gone, and obviously this could be his last year, maybe he'll extend it to next year, we're gonna realize finally how, I don't want to say unappreciated Jimmy was, but how underrated he was behind the wheel.
Yeah, what an amazing accomplishment it was to pull off. I mean, 5 championships in a row is just stupid. That's when you get right down to it. And again, people criticize the fact that he won them in the chase format. If you get down to it, I say winning in the chase format was even harder, because they had to focus on winning in those 10 races.
Yeah, the points are reset.
Where teams that were out of it were already focusing on the next year. And so Chad and Jimmy lost 3 months running through the chase when other guys were working for the next year.
Right.
So they came back for the next year behind the 8 ball, and invariably, I don't have the numbers, but as I remember it, every year they would win 2 or 3 races early. And then they would just kind of go off the radar. And I never heard them admit it, but I'm sure they were testing and trying stuff out to get better for when the chase got there. And it never failed that two or three races before the chase, Jimmy would come back up and win a race. And then they would be on point, and they would go through and win them. And it worked that way for six out of the seven. The 2016 one was a different story. They were out to lunch for most of that year and just pulled it off at the end. But the rest of them, they were behind the teams at the start of each year and still managed to win races, test out stuff, and be the best over those last 10, even though other teams had longer to work at it. And I still think that is such an amazing accomplishment.
Totally agree.
My number three is Curtis Turner. Another one of those guys that, you know, most people will tell you Fireball Roberts was the first superstar in the sport, but Curtis was right there with him. And Curtis was just such a character. If you ever get a chance to read his book, it's hilarious. Talks about he was a timber man and he would fly around and look at trees and stuff. He was a pilot and they wanted lunch while they were out looking at timber. So he landed on Main Street in Spartanburg in his plane and got out, got lunch, got back in a plane and took back off. I mean, just, you know, he famously had a gun pulled on him by Bill France Sr. in a meeting when he was trying to organize a driver's union. And got banned from the sport for several years. But he and Joe Weatherly were buddies, and they ran around, and, man, they had fun. But he helped build Charlotte Motor Speedway. He was a handsome man. He was just a popular with the ladies. I think he was kind of the Tim Richmond, Dale Earnhardt, before those guys came around, and had the charisma and the personality to really attract people to him and to the sport.
That's an interesting one, because if you look at his career, I mean, on the driving side of it anyway, not spectacular. He won 17 races and 184 starts, but those are the stories that where you mentioned how he got a gun pulled on him by by France. That's fascinating, and that's stuff that I feel like everyday people would like to see, and not just that story. That's just the one that stuck out to me from what you said. That's fascinating, and people would love to see it. So,
absolutely,
it fits right in with the Bulls documentary that's currently on, and I feel like my number three pick would also fit into that. And a lot of people had him as their number one. When I sent out the question Sunday night, people mentioned the Man in Black, the Intimidator Dale Earnhardt. Also fascinating. And if you've listened to Dale Jr. Download the past couple of weeks, they've had Doug Richard on. They've had some people of Earnhardt's past to tell stories that even Dale Jr. didn't know.
David Allen was really interesting.
That was very good, yeah. He did the marketing at Wrangler. So Earnhardt, When he was racing, he was NASCAR's Jordan in terms of people feared this man. He refused to lose. He always wanted to be better than the ones around him while ribbing them, you know, playing jokes on them, similar to what Jordan's did we saw in the episodes this weekend. He also challenged NASCAR brass and the officials a ton, you know, a la the Terry Labonte incidents from 99. Never afraid to use that bumper. And an integral part of really growing NASCAR and its fan base. And still today, you see all the number three merchandise being sold. I hate to say it, because Austin Dillon's a good driver, but a lot of that's not from Austin Dillon. A lot of it's from Earnhardt Sr. So,
I haven't delved into merchandise numbers for a few years, but I'm pretty sure Earnhardt is still top 10 in merchandise sales, and a man's been dead for 20 years.
Right. Yeah, that just shows how much of an impact he had in how people related to him. And so I think Dale Earnhardt, that would be a great one. And granted, two of the three I've named had a documentary, like I mentioned, made after him last year with Fox, kind of their rivalry. So that rivalry is fascinating, and those two drivers. And the three I've mentioned, I feel like are fascinating. But Neff, I want to hear who your fourth pick is.
One that I just thought of that I don't know that I would put it in my top four, but would be fun to find, would be Joe Weatherly. And again, I mentioned him with Curtis Turner, and that's what got me thinking about it. But in 1963, Weatherly won a championship and drove for 9 different teams.
Damn.
I would love to see the behind the scenes of just how that worked out. That, you know, he ran most of his races for Bud Moore, but he ran for 9 different teams during that season. That had to be amazing. My fourth one is a toss up. I think I'm going to go with Ken Schrader.
That's a good one.
And that's one of those deals where it's part of it's the NASCAR side, but part of it is just the character side. I mean, the fact that he's still running to this day, he's running somewhere in the neighborhood. At least their plan was to run 70-some races this year. I don't know if they're going to get to it now with the virus stuff. But, I mean, he gets it. He's a man of the people. He spends time in the pits. He travels around and goes to, you know, we saw pictures of him like the Cracker Barrel drive through. He's not standoffish. He's not elitist in any way. He's one of the common folk, and he's run a race in every state in the union, which is an amazing accomplishment because they had to work hard to find a track in Rhode Island, but he pulled it off. But he's been at the mountaintop too. I mean, he ran for Hendrick. He had Budweiser as a sponsor, and you know, he's sat on the pole of the Daytona 500. He's run up front, and he's a character. And I think these documentaries give us an opportunity to see the character of these people. And that's like when he was on Dale Jr. saying, talking about how his finger got cut off. I didn't realize the way he described it was gruesome. When I've talked to him about it personally and heard about it, I thought his finger just got behind the belt and it went around the pulley and it just cut the finger off. No, he said it pulled his finger up into the alternator and that little fan on the front of it just chewed the end of his finger off.
That's gross.
It's like, that's brutal. So, yeah, I mean, just things like that are stories that they might be a little tough to stomach, but it's just intriguing to me, you know, and I've always said I would love to spend a year road tripping with Schrader just because it's got to be an experience unlike anything else.
Yeah, a story like that, if they don't have any graphic images warnings beforehand, I'd probably get sick to my stomach seeing it because my stomach cannot handle stuff like that. But I like that pick a lot, Ken Schrader. Although the NASCAR success might not be there, like you said, character. He only had 4 wins and over 760 Cup starts, but he's still going to this day. I talked to Kenny Wallace last week, who was traveling with Ken Schrader. They're actually on their way home from South Dakota, racing in some dirt races there. This past weekend, they both went to Oklahoma. Still going, still competitive. It's funny, Kenny Wallace finished 12th the first night at Jefferson Park. Schrader finished 13th. The next night at Raceway Park in South Dakota, Wallace finished 8th. Schrader finished 9th. So, still competitive. Great pick enough. I like that one a lot. For my number...
And it was different for them because, especially for Wallace, because they were running IMCA-style modifieds.
Right, he doesn't
which
run
is not
that.
Something that Kenny normally runs. So, for him to be able to outrun Schrader in a car that he's not used to running is impressive.
Right, and he didn't even know about the race. He wasn't scheduled to run until about a week before the actual event. So, pretty impressive for Kenny Wallace there. Now, my number 4, and this could be, I mean, my top 4 really could switch depending on how I'm feeling for the day, what I want to watch. Tony Stewart. And he, out of all the drivers that got listed in the Twitter response, Stewart got the most votes. Him and Earnhardt are probably very close, 1-2. But let's face it, Tony Stewart will race anything under the sun. From winning tons of championships before he got to IndyCar, then won the IndyCar Championship in 1997, while running part-time in the Xfinity Series. In his rookie year, obviously, I was watching a video of this yesterday, kind of preparing for this. He threw a helmet at Kenny Irwin's car, I believe it was at Martinsville, and then went, like, chased the car down on the track. So, Just all the rivalries he's had. In 2000, his second year full-time in Cup, he had runs with Robbie Gordon in practice for the Daytona 500. He had an argument with Jeff Gordon at Watkins Glen later that year. He had infamous dust-ups with Kurt Busch throughout the 2007-2008 season. Threw a helmet again at Matt Kenseth at Bristol in 2012. Who can forget the Joey Logano 2013 comment, where he said he was going to bust his ass for for blocking him.
Yeah.
He's had success in every type of racing he's ever competed in, every form of racing, 3 championships at the Cup level, 49 wins, only 1 finish outside the top 10 in his first 15 season. Challenged media. Like, he was always very witty. We talked about Ryan Newman being witty. Tony Stewart even more so, sarcastically, and he challenged us, and I personally enjoy that. So, I know you said you didn't see this week's Jordan documentary, but even in the first couple, you could see his relationship with the media, and Tony's in the media. I mean, that's a story within itself. So, I think Tony Stewart would be an incredible story to get it on film.
I completely agree with you. And being an Indiana guy and a USAC guy, and I would love to see the story of him winning the Triple Crown, first one to do it. And just, yeah, there's so many different parts to that. And to see, again, being an Indiana guy, the decisions he had to make, and ultimately to give up on that Indy 500 dream to go to NASCAR. I mean, that had to be an enormous decision for him. I'm with you on the media side too. It's fun now. I don't know how fun it was then, but now that he's mellowed, and he probably won't appreciate that statement, but he's a lot more fun now because I think he has a better grasp of the media and what the media means to the sport. And it has changed the way he's interacted. And in the last 5 years or so, I have had some really fun interactions with him. I've always been a huge fan and love what he does. And the other things that would be cool, you mentioned he has the run-in with Kenny Irwin. And then Kenny Irwin passes away.
Mm-hmm.
Tony gave the Irwin family his plane to fly up to New Hampshire to get Kenny's body to fly back with him, and I believe even helped with the funeral expenses. So there's thousands of stories like that of Tony that none of us have ever heard. And those are the kind of things that I would really like to see as well. So if you had one of these documentary series where it goes 5 or 6 parts, one part of it be designed specifically to his philanthropic side, because he has done so much for so many people and has been so generous that just nobody realizes it.
Agreed.
And I think that would be a great piece to learn about
him. Yeah, he's got a huge heart that, I mean, a lot of people in the industry know, but a lot of people outside the industry might kind of see him as a bad boy for his reputation that he's had throughout really his whole career, even while experiencing success on the racetrack. From the media side, that standpoint, I agree with you. He's kind of mellowed out. I know he gave you a hard time at India a few years back.
Yep.
He's given me a hard time once before at a Charlotte Media Tour in 2016, his final year on the circuit full-time. I truly appreciate those challenges, though, because it makes you better. It makes you better in the moment. He's very quick-witted. But even to this day, like every year at Daytona and at the end of the year, but primarily the beginning of the year, the owners will have from Ford will be on, usually it's one day, Toyota the next day, or Chevy the following day. You know, I might be getting those days mixed up, but they'll rotate days. So, you know, after Ford's for the past few years, Stewart, Jack Roush, you know, the Wood brothers, Penske, represent Walt Zarnicki, all of those guys they'll leave the media center, or maybe they'll stick around and maybe do a couple one-on-ones. Tony Stewart stick around for like half hour to an hour just talking to people and just shooting the shit with people. And it's good to see from what his relationship with the media was back in the day. So, look, I'm a big Tony Stewart fan. He's done so much in the sport of NASCAR and really in the sport in racing. Track owner, yep. Even that could be a whole series or a whole, one part. So, yeah, Tony Stewart is my number four. Neff, we'll round this out with number five. Who do you got for number five?
I give you one more quick one, and you mentioned it in fan responses. Tim Richmond. I know there's been a documentary about him, but just his story and the fact that he was so against the grain when he came into NASCAR, and it was such a good old boy Southern sport, and you get this slick guy from Ohio, from a rich family that's coming down, and you know that whether you believe it or not, the argument is that Days of Thunder was kind of based off of Richmond's life story and the fact that he didn't know anything mechanically about the cars. He just got in and drove them. But was a ladies' man, was a party guy, showed up on a Harley wearing the cowboy boots and not dust-covered cowboy boots, like ostrich skin cowboy boots. He was running the big dollars. And it was just, he was so different from what everybody was used to, but God, he was good. And millions of people said it, and I've always said it, if Tim Richmond had lived, Dale Earnhardt does not have seven championships. I firmly believe that. I think Richmond wins three or four and prevents Earnhardt from getting seven. And it would have been, that rivalry would have gone to a whole nother level. And it would have been amazing to watch.
Is that your number five?
Yeah, that's my number five.
Got it. Yeah, that's a good one, too. It would have been cool to see that aspect. If he could have prevented Earnhardt from getting seven. Unfortunately, we'll never know. But, yeah, there's so many. And like we said, like yours stick to when you really, maybe not first got into the sport, but when you were really following the sport for the first time.
Right.
Same here with me. So my number five, and this would be incredible, Dale Earnhardt Jr. There's so many ways you could go with him. In terms of popularity, he was the Jordan of NASCAR for his time. 15 straight most popular driver awards. I listed a lot of his accolades a few weeks ago when we kind of did the Hall of Fame, when we picked who we would select for that. 26 wins. But then, you know, you have his father passing and then the pressure of just being a Dale Earnhardt Jr., the name. He had two Xfinity titles, obviously, in the late 90s. And then also, like, his concussion injuries. And maybe, you know, you have cameras at the 2012 test session at Kansas or whatever. You know, just so much you could dive into with him being an advocate for concussions. From really 2016 on, when he was forced to kind of, you know, get out of the car in New Hampshire for the second half of the year. And then you could, you know, 2017 being his final year, and then 2018 broadcaster, and you could have broadcaster Dale. And then the team owner aspect. There's so many different ways you could go with him. And I think all of them would be appealing to fans. And he is the biggest name probably in NASCAR history. I mean, you could argue that, but 15 straight most popular drivers. I know Bill Elliott's won a ton of them, but Chase Elliott's going to win a bunch of them. But Dale Earnhardt Jr., his story is just incredible.
And he transcended the sport.
For sure.
I mean, that's one of those things where Tiger Woods, Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, those were people that didn't follow their particular sport still knew who they were. And that was the same thing in NASCAR with Dale Jr. He went above and beyond the sport and was, they talked about the Be Like Mike part on the Last Dance, that you were marketing to the society and the social side of it. And that's what you have with Jr. You are dealing with somebody that's being marketed outside of the norm of the sport. And the piece that I would really be interested in with Junior is the first, I guess what I would say is the DEI years.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, we've heard stories of him sleeping in and, you know, and playing video games at all hours. But to really understand, mm-hmm. like, we got a glimpse when Jimmy was on the download talking about they went to Ricky's house and Junior dove into the pool and cut his head open. Those kind of stories we haven't heard out of him. And that's the stories that I really want to know is what went on in that trailer across the street from DEI at 2 a.m. in, like, you know, 99,
mm-hmm.
you know, before his father had passed while he was just young and wild, and to really know how wild got. That's the piece that I would like to see, just because I get the feeling there's some really good stories there that we want to get.
And his decision to leave DEI after 2007. I think that would be a good one, too. His family team. So there's so many ways you could go. I think all the 10 that we've named, and I think you had an honorable mention earlier, there's so many. I mean, we watch racing, and we want to know more about the drivers. We want to know their stories. That's what separates our sport from other sports.
Right.
There's so many we could go into and delve into right now. Unfortunately, we limited it to 5. We could be here for the next day or two talking to you guys.
Easily.
Yeah, about others that we'd like. But, Neff, any final thoughts on The Last Dance? Because overall, like I mentioned at the beginning of this, the Jordan and what ESPN and Netflix have done, and I know they had to bump it up, or decided to bump it up, because of the coronavirus, to give something to watch every Sunday. It's incredible. And it's NASCAR, and I think other sports, like, it needs something like this.
Yeah, I think you're going to see it in a lot of sports.
Yeah. Any final thoughts?
I don't think so. I think Last Dance is cool. I would love to see it from a handful of drivers in our sport. But don't forget, get 20% off and free shipping with the code FRONTSTRETCH at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com if you use our code FRONTSTRETCH. Remember, don't abuse the family jewels. Use the Manscaped mower.
For sure. Now, we got Corey LaJoy coming up on the podcast, Neff. Corey's on off to a pretty good start when we were actually racing in February and March, the first 4 races of the year. This should be a good conversation. Always enjoy Corey. This is the 7th time I believe he's been on the podcast since we kind of started having driver interviews a couple of years ago. Always gives great insight. So let's get to my conversation with Corey LaJoy. All right, Corey, I know you love talking about iRacing. So since we had that over the weekend at Virtual Dover, you were involved in a couple wrecks early. I believe went 4 laps down. Ended up blowing an engine with a few laps left. But overall, how was that experience?
It was good. I mean, I actually was better at it than I expected it to be. You know, those guys spent a lot of time on it where I more or less just started, picked it up a couple weeks ago and spent about an hour practicing, and was able to qualify 5th, which I wasn't supposed to apparently, so I got yelled at. And I didn't get the invite back this week because I guess they were mad. So I'm not in the cool kids club to race the iRacing race this week. But, yeah, I don't know. We had a good run to Talladega. It was good to get our partners on TV and all that, but there's nobody that's ready to get back to real life racing and not have to talk about it than I am.
For sure. I'm sure you'd prefer racing at the real Dover, because seemingly it's one of your better tracks, winning there in K&N and I believe a 6th place in Xfinity, right?
Yep.
We see the same guys typically run up front there in these iRacing events. You've done pretty well at, like you said, the 2nd place at Talladega. I lean on the side of yours. Like, I listen to Sunday Money, your podcast, and how it's a video game. But how much skill is involved with this?
I mean, it's just like anything else, man. The more you do it, the more you get better at it, right? Just like mm-hmm. Call of Duty. If you spend time playing Call of Duty, you can get better at it. Madden, right? If you spend time trying to learn how to ride a unicycle, you can get better at riding a unicycle. One of those things, right? And there are some there are some things that are relative to real life with just trying to find hundreds of seconds, trying to be, you know, trying to hit your marks and be consistent and smooth, and that sort of stuff's relative. But at the end of the day, you know, you're not racing off, you're not driving off feel as much as you are just trying to pick up the visual cues of what the software gives you. You know, it's just, obviously it's not for a lot of people. It seems, I find it odd that guys like cup champions like Jimmy Johnson and Joey Logano and Kyle Busch, all those guys seem to struggle at it quite a bit, which I think because those guys are seat-of-the-pants guys more so than visual cues. You know, and those guys haven't had any success doing on the iRacing stuff, and they've also been spending a decent amount of time on it. So, you know, the guys that do it, obviously it requires some sort of skill. How much that translates to, you know, driving a real race car, you know, the level of courage, I don't think is taken into consideration because there's no circumstances for wrecking. You just hit the reset button and you line it back up and you go again. So, you know, there's when you whistle a thing down at a one at Dover, you know, a lot of the times the reason why you want to lift is because your butt's telling your brain you got to lift because you're going too fast and you're going to wreck more so than what the car's capable of doing. So, you know, you take into consideration that, and that's a whole other element to it.
For sure. Enough of the iRacing. I know you're sick of talking about it, as am I. We've been absent from the racetrack for nearly 2 months now. What have you been up to, Corey, during this time?
Man, our first little guy, Levi, came actually the Wednesday before Atlanta, so he timed it pretty good. He came 5 weeks early, but it's just been a perfect amount of time to spend a lot of time at home with him and the wife and just try to get him on a schedule and learn how to be parents, because there's no you know, owner's manual when they send you home with a kid. You have to try to figure out on your own. So a lot of learning, a lot of giving and taking, and really just I've been spending a decent amount of time at home. I started going out a little bit over the last week or so, working out and going to the cup shop, stopping by there, making sure those cars will be ready to rock when we do get going.
You get any sleep at night or no?
Yeah, I get a decent amount. We found out that he's really fussy between 9 p.m. and midnight. So a lot of times I've been staying up with him through that window, then going upstairs and sleeping through. And, you know, sometimes it's not so good, and sometimes it's not terrible. But, you know, you certainly learn to get your sleep when you can.
For sure. Now, we know that NASCAR is going back racing next week at Darlington. What do you think it's going to be like not having practice or qualifying and having the first laps be in race condition at probably arguably one of the toughest tracks on the circuit?
Yeah, that's a good point, man. It's, hopefully your simulation model's up to date because, you know, we've unloaded and been quite a bit off on packer shims and just overall balance before. You know, and it's almost like it's been an off season. I mean, it's literally been two. How many weeks has it been? 9 weeks or something?
Yeah, it'll be.
We've been off.
Yeah, it'll be 10 when you get back.
Yeah, so I mean, that's essentially almost an off season, and just imagine lining up the first race of the year with no practice, no qualifying, and just fire it off and go. Obviously, the car's going to have a lot of adjustability built into it because the track's going to obviously change a ton from a green racetrack at the beginning of the day towards the end of the day. And, you know, there's a lot of variables that come into it. But, you know, it's the same for everybody, and somebody's going to figure it out. And ultimately, the cream is going to rise to the top. Those guys with fast cars ultimately will find their way to the front at the end of the day. But I do think after 2 or 3 weeks here, I do think driver fatigue is going to come into it because we've never had this workload as drivers ever with, what is that, 4 races in 10 days?
Yeah.
And 2 of the longest ones of the season at Darlington in the 600. So, man, it wouldn't be too far-fetched to think that there's going to be some reserve drivers into play.
Interesting point. How demanding is Darlington? Like, where would you say it lies in ranking in terms of being demanding a track on the schedule?
It's probably fourth or fifth, I'd say. You know, I'd say Dover is probably the toughest on your body. Kansas is another tough one because it's bumpy and it's fairly flat, so you pull a lot of lateral load. Bristol, Martinsville is tough on your body, and then Darlington, just because the track's abrasive and worn out, you know, and you're kind of fighting that thing, and the race is long, it's 500 miles, and the pace isn't quite as fast as it is at Charlotte or somewhere else. So, you know, you're in that car for four and a half hours when, I don't know what the weather's going to be like next weekend, but I'm sure it's going to be hot.
Mm-hmm.
Guys aren't going to be used to sitting in that car wrenched down. You know, I would imagine a lot of drivers have kept some level of fitness up throughout this time, but those guys that haven't really taken it serious or haven't kept their cardio or even just strength training up to somewhat of a decent level, I think those guys are going to have a rude awakening.
Have you ever, I know not at the cup level, but have you ever done that much racing in that short of a span?
No. Probably never, honestly. I mean, it's, I think for NASCAR and really maybe back in the day with like Dick Trickle when he would race four different tracks in four nights, you know, or old modified days, Richie Evans. But in today's times with all the work that goes into these cars each and every week, I think to have teams like mine that expect to turn up a car that's going to race 500 miles of Darlington around in 3 days and race it back is going to be tough. Obviously tough for me to be a little bit conservative when it comes to our strategy on how we race guys, because we don't want to bend that car up and we don't want to get ourselves behind in car inventory.
And not just physically though, either mentally, right? Because that's, I mean, Darlington, you're always on edge.
Yeah. For sure. I mean, I like they don't. There's the it's the only track on the circuit that has its own trademarked form of hitting the wall. So, you know, I told my owner when they were saying they were trying to take the same car back, I said, "Hey, you know, we're going to Darlington, right? We're not going to like Kentucky or somewhere like you don't get up next to the wall. It's just I'm gonna earn my money on next Sunday." And the following Sundays after that, because a team like ours with not a whole lot of inventory, not a whole lot of guys to, you know, catch up when it comes to working a tight schedule, you know, couldn't make it hard for us. I'm going to try to make our jobs fairly easy.
With these one-day shows, do you see that being something that you might be in favor of going forward at select tracks, and could it work out?
What was the question?
Sure. With these one-day shows, obviously at Darlington both days, you know, Xfinity Trucks and Cup, do you see that being something you might be in favor of going forward at select tracks?
Yeah. I mean, I think overall that's kind of been a point of conversation with the leadership of NASCAR on just how to save a little bit of money for the teams is obviously logistics, shortening up weekends a little bit. But I also do think we need to have the long weekends, three-day weekends, where the fans can come tailgate and enjoy the truck races and extended races and see the couple practices in the Cup garage and walk around and do all that. But there's some other, you know, there's certain events where we probably only do need to do a one-day show. And, you know, some of them are two, some of them should be three. But I know NASCAR, I think this is going to give NASCAR a good indication of what's a necessity and what we need to have to keep the racing product and keep fans engaged versus what some of it is fluff and then a change it accordingly for next year's schedule and beyond.
Now, there's only 16 people being allowed per car at these tracks, at least for the foreseeable future. To my knowledge, GoFast only has about 17, 18 employees. So does this affect the team at all, the limit on people?
Yeah, I mean, we don't take a full roster every weekend anyway, so it doesn't really affect us on how we maneuver. And obviously, the only thing the guys are doing at the track are going to be pushing the car through tech, and then obviously the pit crew comes in and does their job. So, you know, I don't know if this. I think the 16 people includes the pit crew as well. So mm-hmm. I think we're going to take somewhere around 5 road crew guys to get the car through tech and do any changes according to what we have to do to comply to the rules. But beyond that, you know, they're not going to have a tough day at the track.
Got it. Corey, I got a couple final quick ones for you, some fun ones too. I know I've told you, I've reached out to you a couple of times and told you how much I enjoy your podcast, Sunday Money. But how much fun are you having hosting that with Daryl and Lauren?
It's always been a good time, man. Sometimes I probably put my foot in my mouth on there with people. That's what probably some people tune in to hear. But, you know, it allows me to kind of tell my story and tell a lot of the things that people wouldn't normally hear just because, you know, it is – you have to be really careful of things you say anymore just because you are so reliant on certain companies' endorsements going forward in your future as well as what you have currently. And you don't want to say anything, obviously, that gets you in trouble or polarizes you to one side versus maybe the values or the ideas of a certain company. So there's lots of things you have to filter when you say it, but I think we've kind of gotten ourselves as a sport over the last several years. We've kind of muffled the personalities a bit, and, you know, I think fans think it's a little bit new and refreshing when they hear a guy like myself just talk about, you know, the struggles of it and you know, how it's not all what it is portrayed on TV. There's a lot of work and a lot of time involved, invested into it, and it's, you know, it's not all $1 million motorhomes and you know, the fanciest toys. But, you know, a lot of guys have that. I don't, but working towards that, you know, and hopefully I can get in a position here in the next couple of years to contend for wins, because I feel like I'm capable of doing that. But for now, trying to get go fast in that 32 car, make that sucker go as fast as this cable going.
Yeah, last week's episode I found hilarious with the bantering back and forth between you and Denny on Twitter. That was fun stuff. But I'll get you out here on this one, Corey. Have you, and you kind of mentioned this, because now you have a voice, but obviously you have a bigger voice now, more of a platform. Have you seen a relevance in your growth in the racing community at all from this podcast?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was cool to see or hear people at the racetrack, you know, y'all Sunday Money, right? So, I mean, it's pretty cool to see, like, your footprint or people care enough to hear what I have to say. And that's never happened, right? Because, you know, just a lot of things have come together over the last six, 8 months, on track as well as off track. That way people are kind of starting to hear about me a little bit more and kind of know what I'm capable of in the right situation. And it's allowed me to kind of just grow a fan base little bit by little bit, because it's easy to grow when you're on TV every week, running well, competing for wins because you're on screen, and that's, you know, there's millions of people every week to watch it and can choose to root for you. But, you know, in a position like mine, you're not on TV as often, so you have to work and get some exposure some different ways. And it's MRN and NASCAR has allowed me to. Sometimes I'm sure they question why, but overall they've allowed me to speak my two cents, and I've learned to not step on some toes, what toes not to step on, I guess I should say, and what areas I could touch on. But you know, that's given me a more of appreciation for the sport to see another side of it that I hadn't before.
Well, cool, man. Appreciate your time. I hope to see you soon. Not sure when that'll be, but good luck next weekend in Darlington. Stay safe.
Thanks,
buddy. All right, y'all. There you have it. Fun conversation there with Corey. Like I mentioned, I believe this is the 7th time being on the podcast, which is by far the most by any driver since we started doing driver interviews on this show a little over 2 years ago now. He always gives great insight. And like I mentioned, got off to a great start before the coronavirus stoppage, sitting 23rd in points ahead of, you know, Tyler Reddick, Ty Dillon, Ryan Preece, Christopher Bell, Daniel Suarez, a lot of these other names that he grew up racing around. Also, really enjoyed that top five list with Neff. That was truly a lot of fun. We both are a little biased, as you could tell, based on our era of racing and how we kind of, how our fandom started in the sport, and how those particular people really hooked us to the sport. But I thought very well-crafted list by both of us. Again, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. And as I mentioned at the start, check us out on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. Really, wherever podcasts are found now. And don't forget to go to manscaped.com and use the code FRONTSTRETCH for 20% off and free shipping. That's it for this week's show. Next week, we'll be previewing an actual race at Darlington. Woo, that's awesome. Great news. But until then, we out.